This is Cecil Prescott with KBOO. We're speaking today with Mark Thompson and Malcolm Boyd, a very powerful, influential, important couple in our culture and in the way we understand what it means to live and to understand our culture. Malcolm Boyd is a prolific writer. He is familiar with many of you from a book he wrote many years ago, Are You Running With Me, Jesus? Mark Thompson is also a writer. He's written for The Advocate over these many years and has written about gay spirituality. We are pleased to have the two of you here today with us, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're here in Portland as part of not only to see the rain, but part of to share with people here in Portland. And I understand you were here at Trinity Cathedral. Tell us about the event there yesterday.
Well, it was terribly exciting, actually, because, it's been years since that high energy. I thought there'd be about three people, and the room was packed, and it was high energy people. Kind of, you filled the time and thought they wanted to go home, but it didn't seem to want to go home. So then I did sort of say Portland, you have to know what city you're in. And they're all different, incidentally. But there was a certain naivete, a freshness, a vulnerability. I mean, these weren't highly sophisticated people not revealing their feelings. And so it was quite an experience for me. I had something... A few remarks prepared to break the ice. If you're a guest speaker, I think that you have to say something at the beginning, and then there can be the Q&A and the dialogue. You can't just say, let's have a Q&A. And so I did have those few remarks, and then some awfully good questions. I mean, very, very deep questions that we got into a lot of depth there, I thought, yesterday, and I love doing that. And that doesn't happen every day anywhere, frankly, Years ago, when I did several national book tours, and that's something else, too, where you're doing maybe 10 interviews a day, and from the local Today Show in the morning to CBS at midnight. And it's kind of, I don't think there's any great sense in that. It's just kind of arduous. But I think if you dip into a culture or a city and do a few things that matter, and can be yourself, I think there's value.
Mark, I understand you grew up on the West Coast. Is that correct?
Yes, in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Coming here to Portland, have you been here before?
I've always wanted to come here all my life, and this is my first visit, and I'm having the most incredible sense of deja vu. You know, it's like I turn around every street corner and I go, I somehow feel I've been here before.
Right.
And I'm just having the most wonderful experience. I think Portland, I've just completely fallen in love with the city and the people and the culture here. It's a wonderful place.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we thank you for joining and being entering our city and enjoying it. And we welcome you here. One of the things I wanted to talk with the two of you today, and I introduce you as power couple or cultural icons. I think for many lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people, it's important to have, for lack of a better term, role models. And the two of you, whether you want it or not, are often seen as a couple, not only as people who've been together for almost a quarter of a century, but also at the ability to look at culture and spirituality. As you work together, perhaps you could take us back to when you first came together. No one can ever understand what the future is like. But when you either met one another, or did you see, and was there an immediate connection, and were you attracted because of your interest in cultural or spirituality, or was it just something else that brought you together and your work together?
Well, when I first met Malcolm, I was just moving to Los Angeles and for work reasons, and we were introduced by a mutual friend, and I had an immediate attraction to Malcolm because I thought, here's an extremely intelligent person, a wonderful writer, someone very passionately committed to issues of social change and justice issues. I thought, well, this is very impressive. And my heart was stirred, but I thought, oh, he's an Episcopalian. I don't know anything about Episcopalians. Coming from the Bay Area, just kind of more of, kind of that Zen, Buddhist, radical, fairy kind of mix that we have up there.
Yes.
But I quickly learned a lot, and I thought, well, Alan Watts is someone who managed to bridge that gap in his life, and I knew a lot about Alan Watts, the great writer and philosopher, and I thought, well, if he can be an Episcopalian and a Zen Buddhist at the same time, so can I. But aside from that, it was Malcolm's work and his devotion to change.
I was very vulnerable. It was a funny time. I'd been closeted, of course. And I did come out in Are You Running With Me, Jesus, I'm with you, Jesus, in a homosexual bar, yes. In 1965. But of course, and Time magazine picked up on that by just printing the prayer and not commenting, which is so Time. But then I came out publicly then in 77. But in the closeted years, had been in about a 15-year relationship with someone, obviously. Well, what can you say? Great and interesting and all that. But this is someone who who didn't wish to come out, and you might say didn't feel able to or wanting to, really. So I did feel the need as a writer and a priest. Otherwise, one was living a lie. So then I left the relationship, and we'd owned a home and had a life. So I was very adrift, scared, lonely, confused. So anyway, and then here's Mark. So, I mean, I don't know. I was, I didn't have anything in mind, and I don't think either of us did. We were there, and we met, and we interacted. But we were kind of like Marco Polo in China or something, weren't we? In other words, we're on a new ground.
Well, the gods seemed to be speaking, like saying, hey, this is a good thing,
yes.
And so go for it. But, of course, I've been out my entire life. Mm-hmm. I'm what I would say of the Stonewall generation. Mm-hmm. So I graduated from high school in 1970. Mm-hmm. So that was the year after the Stonewall riots, and I had a gay brother. I grew up with a gay brother. who has since deceased from AIDS. But we were very cool about it. Mm-hmm. We grew up on the Monterey Peninsula, and that was, very close to nature and kind of a liberal, and there were many gay and lesbian people. And my father took me out to the garage one night, where all these kind of manly conversations have to happen, apparently.
Right.
And he told me, he said, that's okay.
Wow.
That's okay. And so that's never been an issue. The issue for me has been the systematic oppression of gay and lesbian people and people of otherness or differentness. Mm-hmm. And that just seemed to me to be wrong. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be an important thing that I could devote my life work to, correcting that in any way that I could, to point out what I thought was the obvious. That the kinds of people that we're calling gay and lesbian today, I think we've had many different names over the time in different cultures, but we are a necessary people on the planet, and any culture and any society should feel lucky to have us, because I think we add a lot of grace notes that are very, very important. Mm-hmm. And so this systematic destruction and erasure of our history, of our lives. I mean, I became very aware very early that the history of gay and lesbian people in the United States was really a sad one. Mm. And despite how Hollywood, Will and Grace and all of these kind of popular takes on it, I mean, this is not the real history. The real history has been of murder, suicide, incarceration. I grew up meeting gay men Malcolm's age. We're 30 years apart, just to let your viewers know. Mm-hmm. intergenerational couple. But I grew up meeting gay men who had been assigned to psychiatric wards by their families.
Yes.
And given shock treatments, thinking that that would shock them out of who they were. Mm-hmm. So I was very aware at a very early age of this crime.
Yes.
Just to underscore this a little, I was gay through the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s. 70s, 80s, 90s, and so forth. For example, in none of the schools I ever attended where I was receiving supposedly an education was gay ever mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in no church where I ever worshipped was it ever mentioned, and in my family it was never, I mean ever, mentioned. Then I was caught up in the civil rights movement very mm-hmm. much. I was a freedom rider in 1961. I was with King numerous occasions. So all of that was happening to me, which had to do with freedom. And then here was the anomaly of my own life, no connection. And also, I'm supposed then not to have any self-esteem. But we're dealing culturally and socially with movements that are dealing with self-esteem. So I suppose, I'm not going to say inevitably things mm-hmm. came to a head, but because of who I am and the dynamics in my life, they did.
I think part of Malcolm's story and our story together, and we aren't consciously role models, we're just living our lives. Mm-hmm. But we deeply believe that love of self, mm-hmm. you know, and self respect and learning how to do that comes first. And then once you are able to do that, then you have love left over to love someone else, such as I love Malcolm, and then love your community and mm-hmm. be a part of it. We really believe in being a part of a community and building community. And we do that through our books. And so that's why Malcolm's here, right? You have a new book coming out.
Yes, I do. But I was just going to, mm-hmm. for just a second, leap into something that Mike was saying about the role model business. We're an intergenerational couple. And incidentally, Christopher Isherwood and Don Bacardi are also were 30 years apart, and they were role models then yes. for us. So I can understand this process. But there was a time when if you were gay, you didn't want to be older, because then you would be maybe less, quote, attractive or something. And I'm an elder. And Mark is, you know, approaching this and is in many ways. But the point is, you do have youth, not just in the gay community, but any community. And then you have the adult, and then you have the elder. And then already now they're saying you have ancestors. And it's kind of strange for me, because with Martin Luther King, there wasn't a thought of an elder or an ancestor or really anything, but just a man kind of tired with his sleeves rolled up and sweaty and working to get through the day. Of course he's an ancestor now and more. So in all of this, it's introduced a role for everybody, I think, because there can't be the youth unless the adult will play the adult role with the youth. Mm-hmm. And then I have found lately that there cannot be the adult unless the elder will accept the responsibility for being the elder and will be the elder to the adult. This is very serious stuff, I think. Well, I mean, we're told about the role model, and I honor it. Not that we're playing a role.
It's just something that happened.
But we're just who we are, and yeah. it's authentic.
Yeah.
We have a lot of young, we have friends of all walks of life, of course, in Los Angeles, but some of our young gay friends, particularly young men, I mean, they come up to me, and I've also done, I'm a clinical psychologist, so I've done work with gay and lesbian youth on that level. And there's this kind of still this myth that there's this like barcode stamped on our behind somewhere, and you know, we hit 40 and ding, we're through, you know. And I'm going, no, that's just when life starts to get interesting, you know. So hang in there and learn to love yourself, and don't do crystal meth, you know, which is a really big problem in our community right now.
In every community.
Stay healthy, stay alive, and it'll get better.
When I was young, if you hadn't made it by 30, you know, just take a pill and jump off the cliff. I mean, 30 was it. And then there was a best-selling book that really was important, and it was called Life Begins at 40. And that was utterly revolutionary because people said, well, what an utter lie. Life doesn't begin at 40. I have lines in my face. I have no energy. I'm through. You know? So, I mean, this was a liberation situation. So I think in a way, all of this is involved in everyone's personal struggle to be authentic and get, in a Zen sense, live in the moment. And I think now there are a lot of possibilities. If people, I think some kids who very sadly in high school do get into very heavy drugs, they're limiting chances a great deal. And so are everybody has their own drug, I suppose. But across the board, I think there's a lot of hope for people if they can place themselves in a certain context. And a goal is important and motivation is important.
As my friend, a wonderful poet, a regional poet from up in this area, James Broughton, always said, Mark, adventure, not predicament.
Yes.
I love that.
So that's kind of how we live our life or try to. It's a fascinating adventure.
You're listening to KBOO. My name is Cecil Prescott. We're speaking today with Mark Thompson and Malcolm Boyd, two fascinating men who have a long history of activism and caring and building community. As the two of you were speaking, and Mark, you mentioned the importance of community, I was reflecting on Malcolm's life, and you just touched a little bit about your history in terms of your involvement in social justice movement. And it occurred to me recently that oftentimes that lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people have been involved in various movements for social justice. Mm-hmm. You mentioned your history. You know, you were a freedom rider and involved in the civil rights and anti-war movement. I often wonder, and maybe Mark, you might have a perspective on that, what draws us to these movements? And oftentimes we have been silent and not able to assert our voice, but being there for others. Is there something in our spirits, in our souls, that attracts us to work for?
Oh, I think very much. I look at the role of gay and lesbian people, basically, as we're a differently gendered kind of people. I mean, by saying different, I don't mean better than. I mean, people often misinterpret that. I feel it's just something in our DNA, and there's more and more studies are being done and shown that, yes, we are different in terms of how we kind of perceive life and connect the dots. And what are our cultural roles? What are our archetypes, you know, that inform our psyche, our souls, our actions? And one of those very much is being agents of social change, being wounded healer types, you know. And so if you connect with how you've been wounded and become in a right or good relationship with that, then you're able then to assist others. I mean, throughout American history, and all this has been pretty well erased, but it's all coming out now in our time. I mean, I look at people like Bayard Rustin, you know, who organized
The
March on Washington, and he couldn't come out. You know, they didn't want him to come out. And that March on Washington would not have happened if it had not been for Bayard Rustin. And it's taken, 50 years for the truth to finally come out. Yes. Malcolm's role, for instance, you know, which was a very prophetic role, and he couldn't come out. And this is what I love about Malcolm. He's so brave and so courageous, because when he did come out, he went from being one of the prince and poster boys of the church to a pariah. And he couldn't get a job. I mean, he was dropped like a hot potato. No one would hire him, you know. Just very, very wrong.
In coming out, it was interesting. I was trying to figure out kind of how to do that, you know. And there was an editor of a good magazine. I said that I would come out in the pages of the magazine. And then she wrote and said, I can't let you do that because you would be destroying your usefulness.
Yes.
Well, thanks a lot. It's sort of like I remember meeting someone once who said, you know, I hope you suffer, because when you suffer and then, you know, write about it, or I feel your suffering, your pain, your torture, it is so helpful to me. And if you ever weren't suffering, then you couldn't be there for me any longer in this role. So all of this is a part of something that has a very kind of insane humor to it, in a sense. So I didn't even come out in exactly, it was flawed. I didn't have any control over it. And I was involved in something where I couldn't explain. And I was written off by a number of people. I too have felt very close to Bayard Rustin particularly. But it's time with all of this history now to stop this. Tape is rolling, as they say, and there is no time. But there shouldn't be anyone else who... let's be ourselves and let's be open to each other. And I think there is a lot of openness on the part of an awful lot of people now to gay folk that wasn't true. Mm-hmm. As I think racially, there has been obviously huge difference from not being able to have a cup of coffee at the counter. On the other hand, having said that, you still have the iceberg, and we're on the Titanic, and the iceberg is huge and it's dangerous. So we have not, unfortunately, really dealt with racism much at all, I'm afraid. And I just wonder, in this other instance now, on the whole gay issue...
Well, the homophobia in this culture still runs so deep. Mm-hmm. We were at the, Saturday night here, we were visiting at the Q Center, the new GLBT center that's... just started here in Portland, and of course these kind of places are popping up or have already in the big cities, but now in some of the smaller cities or mid-cities like Portland, and it's so exciting to see these places for community to come together and organize, and so we were quite taken by the Q Center, and they're working with gay kids and families and all kinds of exciting issues. But Malcolm, you mentioned insane humor, and I think that, again, is one of the roles that we gay folk have, you know, to point out the follies of others. And that's what I love about your new book, Samuel Joseph for President, because it's a collection of satire and very wicked wit. I think your book is a very good example of that.
Well, you did that so well. I was wondering when we were going to get to Samuel Joseph for President. And, you know, I found that a really fascinating volume in terms of the writings, the stories in there, and the religious allegories. It was just great. So tell us about the writing of the book and the stories it created over a number of years.
It's true, recent. Yes.
When I was reading the first short stories, Samuel Joseph for President, I thought, like, was this written in 1990, you know, year 2000, you know? And
well, actually, that was written probably in the 60s.
Right, exactly.
But, that's of course, it's even more relevant right now,
yes,
I think.
Yes, exactly.
And there's some, I love that there's this right-wing guy, kind of an elder of the right wing, who's really a bad guy. But anyway, his name is Pinckney, and there's a line in the book, Pinckney sipped his glass of milk, which is, I'm fond of it. It's an exposure of that kind of phoniness that's also Hitlerian, it's dangerous. It's like, you know, there's a cobra in the backyard. Because it's ostensibly about can a Jew be elected president, but it's far, far deeper than that. And it's basically the opposition, the fundamentalist, that would say no, you know, no, 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 onto a number of things. The kid who plays Jesus in the $200 million Life of Christ, I'm fond of him. He doesn't know who he is, and he can't find himself. So he can kind of play Jesus or something, but he can't be himself, you know. Study in Color is a short play kind of format in the book. I think it's the deepest piece. I wrote that and then appeared in it a number of times in Detroit, Michigan coffee houses.
Oh.
And then I played the white man
with the black mask.
Black mask, right. Black shirt, black pants, yeah. Black socks, and black shoes. Mm-hmm. And then Woody King, an actor who later went to New York, put on the white mask mm-hmm. and the white stuff. And we're exploring the absurdity of color, except it's far more than that. It's not simply absurd, but the whole thing we've gotten into with the race as the American cancer has an absurdity at the deepest level. It's deeper than hypocrisy. It's demonic. But anyway, that study in color was done in all over the country on hundreds of campuses and the National Cathedral, and it has a history. And I hope that can be anthologized, and I think Study in Color ought to be done again.
When did you write that?
I think I wrote Study in Color because it was right after the Freedom Ride, kind of, and maybe 62 or 63. Uh-huh. Mm. But I'm saying it grew as a work because we kept performing it,
yes.
You see. So I had fun with the book in the sense of having fun when you break new ground.
Well, what I think is hilarious about the one story about the movie, about the $200 million Jesus movie, because I can't get Malcolm to see those kind of movies at home.
Really?
I love old movies, and I love the Ten Commandments, and he said, oh, I won't see that. That's I can't see those kind of movies.
But my first book was an attack on Mr. DeMille and the Ten Commandments. And I was terribly earnest and young, and lacked a sense of humor, which I admit. But I was the avenging god against Charlton Heston and DeMille, yes, and Hollywood and phoniness and the whole bloody thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was going to save the world at 26, mm-hmm, let's say. So, and I still think people should save the world at 26. Yeah. But the point is, I didn't.
Well, so it's one of my roles in our relationship is to instruct and teach Malcolm the role of camp humor. So, I mean, that's, you know, it's nice that there's still a little learning curve there.
He's making progress.
I'm making progress. Camp humor is very, very, very important. I just wanted to get in one last word, if I could, and I don't want it to sound too shameless, but because we're both authors and we're also here to talk about this book, which is very important, and between us, we've written over 35 books and countless essays and contributed pieces, and so we're a great believer in we're book people, mm-hmm, and we love books.
We're books.
And okay, with some pages still to be turned, but I just wanted to give a shout out for the publishers of this book, mm-hmm, Ken Arnold and his wife Connie Kirk have just started this new publishing company here in Portland, mm-hmm, Ken Arnold Books. I think it's such a brave act to start a progressive publishing company, and they have a fascinating lineup, mm, of very progressive and enlightened authors, of which Malcolm's book is just the first. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to acknowledge them and their work in helping the culture to change and grow through books.
They're a vital part, in a sense, now of not only U.S. culture and American culture, but Portland culture. Mm-hmm. They're here, mm-hmm. and it's a national publisher, but based in Portland. And you know what? It's kind of like the big book chains can't. Mm-hmm. That is corporate America.
Right. It's so over.
In a way, I certainly do hope so. But then you have in each community usually one or two struggling bookstores,
independent bookstores,
where the radical visitor can speak and people can come, and it's more than a bookstore. It's kind of a holy place.
Mm-hmm. You were speaking of community.
Community. Yeah, and I think books still are, the internet, of course, has changed how we live, but I still think that books have an incredibly valuable role, and particularly the kind of books that this publisher is starting to turn out. We're very, very supportive.
That's great. It's a, and I look forward to reading more books put out, because if this is an example of the type of work, mm-hmm. It's really important and critical in our society to have volumes such as this. One thing that I found fascinating, because I discerned that a lot of this pieces were written like in the 60s, mm-hmm. But it was a relevancy for today, so I don't know whether or not you were able to forecast into the future, but in terms of your analysis of the role, mm-hmm. The intersection between religion, culture, and even corporatism, you know, mm-hmm. the role of mass media, Madison mm-hmm. Avenue, in terms of, in several of these stories about bringing in the advisors, how are we going to sell a person for president, or right. how are we going to create this new religion in America. So I thought you were very key in seeing that connection between what I would think, you know, pure religion and how it's sometimes influenced by other sources in our society.
Well, I think we're at a tremendous crossroads. We all know that we're at a crossroads, I hope, except I don't think we all do know. The introduction of actual torture, I think, has changed a lot of our perception. In other words, I think America has to now face, whether it's going to be Rome, and to kind of go under fairly quickly. In fact, it could then have gone under before anyone knew it had gone under, because you have the whole corporate structure now and global, and then you have the manufactured ideas that go with the manufactured goods, and then you have the pop glamour celebrity culture now as much in Poland as Hollywood. So it's a very dangerous moment.
Well, you see, we live literally in the heart of Los Angeles, and we're seeing the culture there begin to unravel mm-hmm. at an increasingly, it's awful to see. It's just, it's a very rapidly deteriorating. I mean, we've had three school shootings in just mm-hmm. in the week before we came up here, wow. involving, you know, hundreds of people. People are angry, enraged, curse each other on the roads. Mm-hmm. There's no civic discourse. There's violence in the air.
And then with this, of course, you have the hardworking, struggling family whose kids cannot receive an education in the overcrowded classroom with the teacher who can't handle it anymore, who has no opportunity. A situation where health care is not available, a situation where the house may be foreclosed, actually unemployment. In other words, there was this idea, and maybe middle class was the term, that everybody was kind of looking for, and it meant privileges and safeguards, and certainly meant retirement. Maybe we'll travel a little. Well, now we're just seeing the complete breakdown of the whole thing. And then more and more people, I think, are becoming aware that they are breaking down because the systemic thing for them has ended. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to look forward.
So that's why we are really encouraging people to read, because that's, I think, how communities can come together. It begins as a community of readers, a community of ideas, of shared thoughts. as a hedge against hopelessness. You know, there's a lot of hopelessness in the air, people feeling stuck and trapped. And good books, you know, can offer people windows to examine new modalities, new ways that they might live in relationship to themselves, to their loved ones, to their neighbors. You know, it's got to start somewhere. We're not going to get it on the TV. We're not going to get it on the internet, as much as some people would say that we are. I'm not convinced.
Well, the internet and the cell phone are actually, instead of bringing people together,
are separating people.
I think in a sense, your station, in a very ironic sense, is a kind of church, synagogue, mosque. Talk about community, that's what you're into. And providing and enabling. So some people listening to us, even at this moment, we're in community together. And without this opportunity, we couldn't be. And I think we're down to survival time now. So these things become very important. We should be grateful for them. We have to support them. But more than that, we have to participate now, all of us. We've got to get involved in many ways that we, hadn't thought we would.
One of the ways in which we can get involved, as you two have been sharing, is reading. And I want to, tell our listeners to pick up this volume by Malcolm Board, Samuel Joseph for President, subtitled Media, Politics, Religion, and Race, and is published by a local publisher here in Portland, Ken Arnold Books. And it's a fascinating book of four essays, I believe, five essays. And just want to encourage everyone to pick it up and, talk to your neighbors and form little discussions groups around it. Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, and I just had one other thought on my mind. I knew of you, Father Board, as an Episcopal priest, and then I found, reading something about the two of you, that you were the first couple that had your relationship blessed by a sitting bishop in the Episcopal Church. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts, any conceptions about, what will happen in the Anglican Communion and the Lambeth Conference and all of that.
I thought it was a lovely day, but some people apparently thought maybe the gates of hell were going to open. But Malcolm, I'll let you address that because I stay out of church politics.
Well, honey, you're in the middle of church politics.
I love it.
No,
I'm just a humble clergy spouse. Right. I have to stay out of these things, but I do have my opinions.
Yeah. So are you baking the pies?
No. I just make sure he. Matter of fact, we are with Mary Bruno, who's the wife of our wonderful bishop down there in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. We decided to start a group for the spouses of clergy, and this will be men and women, mm-hmm. Gay and straight.
This is the first time in the world.
The first time, because we're the consummate behind the scenes people, exactly. And frankly, it's not going to run very well if we're not happy.
Mm-hmm. Mark is taking his responsibilities seriously as a spouse,
but I'm not going to get into any. Camp humor on that, okay.
However, I am barred from. I'm not a. There can't be two spouses, apparently.
No.
So I'm barred from the meetings because the spouses will meet without. Yeah.
And so will the bishop, by the way. So.
Yes. That was an amazing and wonderful experience. That was very, very deep.
That was what year were you?
About 20th anniversary.
The 20th anniversary, mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, there's something in Celtic religion that's a concept that's interesting, that between earth and heaven, as it were, there's a very thin line, not a separation. And I felt once in the civil rights, I was with four young black guys from SNCC, and we were doing voter registration in the Deep South, and we'd sleep on shack floors in the country, and poor families would feed us, and of course the police were the enemy. And one Sunday, I kind of was thinking of church, and of course we couldn't go to a building. I mean, we'd be arrested. But there was some moldy bread and warm beer, and we had communion. And for me, on that day, it was a thin line. And I felt the same way about our the blessing. There was the community of the people there and ourselves, and then some of Mark's personal family. It meant a great deal to him, and aunt and uncle. And anyway, we were all there. And then I believe six bishops chose, which was very nice. And so it was a community and an role model, if you like.
Well, Malcolm, it was also a wonderful example of how things are changing, yes, can change, the possibilities that can exist. You know, marriage is not for everyone, mm-hmm, but if you want to, you know, consecrate your union in that way, we should certainly be able to. This whole opposition to gay marriage, I don't understand, because it's just the further demonization of gay people and keeping gay people from being healthy into themselves.
And from being acknowledged.
And being acknowledged. And then if we're not healthy to ourselves, then we're not healthy in our communities. It's never made any sense to me. Mm-hmm.
But let's end our conversation by just asserting that you two are about building community, and your life, your writings, your work testifies to that. I just wish you continued good health, good writing, and just thank you for being who you are and modeling for many of us in our society what it is to live in community and to build community. We've been speaking this day with Mark Thompson and Malcolm Boyd. Malcolm Boyd is the author of many volumes, but today we touch upon Samuel Joseph for President. It's, you know, it's a timeless satire. I like that. Timeless satire by Malcolm Boyd, and his publisher is Ken Arnold Books here in Portland, Oregon. Thank you, too, for joining with us at KBOO this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.